Before we get started with today's show, I want to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, 30 for 30. 30 for 30 podcast and The Undefeated present King of Crenshaw. This four-part series examines how Nipsey Hussle's life, death, and legacy impacted the sports world, particularly the NBA. Here, DeMar DeRozan, Isaiah Thomas, and DeMarcus Cousins, among others, explore the realities of life as a black man in America. Nipsey's dedication to South LA and his community, and how Nipsey inspired millions. The marathon continues. King of Crenshaw. Listen now on SiriusXM, Pandora, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Also, if there's a game, someone's betting on it. Stream Season 2 of Better Days, the Mike Greenberg-hosted series that brings the true stories of unforgettable gambling adventures to life. All episodes are now streaming, only on ESPN. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, we got a little time with Justin Tinsley. He did a great 30 for 30 podcast called King of Crenshaw on Nipsey Hussle. We'll talk about that. But first, it is Foxworth Friday, the host of the 2021 Charity Tribute Tournament that I won. Dominique Foxworth, what's going on?
What's happening, man? The tournament was a hit, man. I had a great time. It was fun. The people seemed to love it. And you put the cherry on top with your I don't know if I can call it celebration. I don't know how to define what you did, but it was masterful.
What I did was give the people what they showed up for.
That's fair.
So that's what it's like to be Tom Brady. You know what I'm saying? like when you show up and everybody's like, well, that dude going to be in the Super Bowl. And if you're not in the Super Bowl, people don't even want to watch the Super Bowl no more. And then like once you get to the Super Bowl and you Tom Brady, that's when everybody wants you to go down because they want a little variety. You know what I mean? That's how they wanted to play. But then in the end, you come out victorious and you realize, nah, that's what they really wanted.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right, because I think a lot of people were, especially from the beginning when I was saying we have to change the name of the tournament if you lose, like the pressure was on you. A lot of people were rooting against you, I would suspect, as most people would have thought it was funny to have somebody come in and knock you off on the tournament that bears your very own name. I don't know that I could imagine. I'm imagining everyone else winning and nobody like would have given the people the gift that you like. That part was hilarious.
You know what it was? Because I had to make all them punk asses understand when they was rooting against me in the first place. And then they came around. I wanted them to still know that I know that they is a bunch of punk asses. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know how that goes sometimes? People try to jump on the winning team and act like they've been there the whole time. But I know they hadn't been there the whole time. I seen what they was out here talking about, right? I feel like I got a decent set of people that like really rock with me, like the people that really like me. I feel like I got that out here in these streets. There was nowhere to be found.
The us at this point, we comment on competitors often and so rarely. Like, obviously, I was a competitor at one point, but so rarely do we find ourselves in the position of the competitor. You have a new outlook on analysis and commentary going forward now that you had to endure the hate.
Nah, you know what it comes down to for me, honestly, man. Like, I got a lot of competition in me and I'd be turning that down. I really do. Yeah. I don't feel like it brings out the best in me. I do my best really just to compete with myself as best as I can. And I realize after dominating a field that it's best that I approach the world like that. Like, y'all don't want me to be like this every day. I can't be out here just like, you know, I ain't trying to be Michael Jordan just every day out here looking for miserable. Something to win. You know what I mean? Yeah. That's not a happy thing. So like, I want y'all to feel good and every now and then get a victory at something, you know, maybe it's against me.
I hadn't planned on this turning into a press conference about your win, but
no, but please, the people didn't get a chance to find, you know, I've had time.
I'm sure if they didn't listen, they'll go back and listen now just to hear the final 10 minutes of the podcast was on fire. And the questions were so good. It set up a couple suspenseful questions, but your point about competition is something, I don't know if we've talked about this before, but I had somebody tell me a while ago that the operating system that brought you to this point may not be the best operating system going forward, like analogizing a person's own mindset with a computer operating system. Mm-hmm. And you brought that competition thing up and that struck a chord with me. It's something that stuck with me probably the last 8 years now. Is like, I was that super competition-aholic and it worked. It got me where I was. And then it was making me miserable. Like, after I was done playing, and like, I was like, all right, I'm done. Like, I wasn't the best player in the NFL, but like, making it to the NFL, essentially, I dominated life up until that point. And I was like, all right, we're going to keep going dominating life. I'm going to go to the best business school. Then I do that. And then I'm like, okay, I don't feel no happier. I just feel more pressure. Like, this ain't making me happy. Then I've moved on to the MBPA. And eventually, I came to realize that you got to control. It's not easy. It's not a switch. You know, you can understand this. It still peaks up.
Well, like, I got a couple of them, right? And I'm going to do them in, like, not quite sequential order, but they both involve working here. So I got the call to do Around the Horn for the first time in 2010. And I remember my outlook and approach to that was I had two choices. I could go out here and try to campaign to make sure they call me again, or I could just be like, they're never going to call me again. Let's make it happen. Because for those of y'all who came up late, you don't really understand this. Like, when I got on, it was really very similar to, like, if the dude that was killing it hooping in your neighborhood suddenly turned up in the NBA, right? Like, you know, like, for me, it was not like, yes, all this hard work has gotten me to where it was. It was like, yo, I'm here. Oh, okay. So I, you know, like, this ain't going to happen again. And man, right. I'd be going out there on Around the Horn. I misunderstood how competitive it really was or wasn't.
Right. Right.
I was coming to destroy. I was coming to destroy everyone. And I didn't know them. So I had no rapport. So I'm coming. They're like, yo, who the hell is this? Like, I look back on it when I moved to New York in 2017.
You were young, too.
Yeah, I just turned 30. I just turned 30.
That's hard because the Around the Horn, the panelists at that time were.
Yeah, you got to remember.
Like seasoned columnists.
Yeah, the young dudes on Around the Horn didn't come around till after me. Like, that's kind of the inflection point. Like, outside of, like, Michael Smith, you know, who had been there forever at that age. But, like, it didn't really become more the youth movement until after. And so I'm there and. Over the years, it all calmed down. We all got good, whatever it was. But I look back on it now and I was just like, hey, man, I was playing a different game than they were. I was coming to destroy. But there's one I've never told this story publicly, but I am going to tell the story now.
Yes.
So I want to say it was either August or September. I think it was 2010. It must have been either 2010 or 2011, but I'm pretty sure it was 2010. This is back when First Take operated. Like in the cold pizza format. So it wasn't debate for 2 hours. There were four segments in the show that were debate. It was first and 10 is the way they did it, right? Like there were 10 downs that went through. And so it'd be Skip Bayless on his side and they would have a different person every day. And so I had campaigned for a while to get on and finally they got me on. And so the thing for me was like, I ain't trying to come up on your show and house you. Like Around the Horn, the person whose show it is not a competitor. You know what I'm saying? Right. But I was like, I ain't really trying to come on. And I ain't got no beef with Skip, right? Like, I don't need to come in here and try to destroy Skip. So I'm trying, you know, I know how to act. I was raised, right? You know what I'm saying? I'm trying to be polite in somebody else's home. And once a month I go on and we did it for like the first 3 months. And it wasn't great because there wasn't a lot of back and forth. I'm approaching this a bit different. Right. And so the fourth time I'm there, there's a, you notice there's this early ass production meeting for First Take. Let's say 7:30 in the morning. And so this is when it was in Bristol, right? So I'm in the room, I'm in Bristol. We in there, it's me. I forget who, you know, the producers are in there. My man, the great Jason Romano, he's in there. And Jason said, hey, Skip, Derek Brooks just sent a tweet asking who was your toughest opponent. And he said, Greg Anthony. And I was kind of joking. I look at Skip and I'm like, hey, man, baby, I'm right here. And he looked at me serious like and was like, Greg Anthony. Ooh. And I was like, oh, okay. What happened for the next 2 hours? I'll woe his ass out. I mean, I just decided. I was like, oh, okay. He ain't going to say nothing like that again. I came to take him up and down. Like, I was trying to do it like them videos you see of the police where they arrest the dude. And when they taking him out, they accidentally hit his head against the door frame. You know, it's like, oh, wow, we keep bumping you into everything. I remember one of the topics was, it was 2010, because that's when Vic was killing it with the Eagles. And the question had come up, which quarterback would you want to have right now? And this wasn't long after that game against Washington where he just destroyed on Monday Night Football. And so I was going with Vic. And so Skip, and the thing about Skip is, Skip take this for real, right? And so you got to know, Skip don't tell you nothing about what he's going to say before. Like, it's all, none of that. So Skip comes out and he's got this long thing about Peyton Manning. I mean, not a bad call, right? It's Peyton Manning. And so he goes through, you know, 75-time Pro Bowler, you know, and everything. And he went through all these historical stats about Peyton Manning. And I looked at him and was like, I thought we was talking about right now. Because you got to remember, 2010 was the year before the neck surgery. Like, that was not the best version of Peyton Manning we've ever seen. And then he comes with some more stats about Peyton Manning. And I was just like, I was straight on some, like, hood, nanny, nanny, boo-boo type stuff. I'm like, right, but I thought we was talking about right now. Like, I ain't refuting it. I ain't arguing back. I'm like, I thought we was talking about right now, dog. Oh, and then I forgot one of the last topics. This is when Kobe had done that Call of Duty commercial. So he's in there with like the AR or whatever. And we were talking about whether or not that's a bad look. But that's a wheelhouse topic for me. I'm in there breaking it down. I'm like, yeah, the thing is, if he had a gun in a Grand Theft Auto commercial, we would all acknowledge that it's a problem. But there's certain violence that we can appreciate, right? You know, in the middle of all this stuff. Man, I'm just destroying. After the show the first three times, Skip had always said goodbye.
Not that time.
And that was the last time that I was ever invited to come do First Take with Skip Bates.
All right. I've already found a video. I can't watch it now because we're recording this. I found some clip, but I'm going to check this out after the show. I can't wait. But that.
Dog, I was wrecking it. And I realized competition. It's not always what's going. I even thought that this was a competitive environment. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
No, my desire to come destroy did not help me in that case. Cause at that time I was getting paid by the appearance. You know what I'm saying? Like did not do well by me. And I'll tell you this too. I once saw somebody go on a show with Skip and they was bringing it to him. Right. And I called that person and I was like, hey, you need to understand something. I get where you're coming from. Right. But that show, the role of winner of the debate is already filled. They are not looking for a champion. They are looking for somebody else to participate. Like, I'm just here to tell you now, probably think that he respects the back and forth. He respects the workout. That's not how it works. Yeah. That dude was never on there ever again.
That was understanding that it's entertainment is something that we all have to learn at some point, I think, in this business. I was fortunate enough that Stephen A taught me that. Like you, I'm competitive, and I was trying to crush Stephen A the first time they had me on there with him. He wasn't concerned about that. Like, he takes it seriously, but unlike, at least my experience, unlike Skip, he's like, all right, well, took a L, you move on. And he talked trash, and he'll sell the next fight, air quotes. He'll sell the next fight off of that. But I was, like, bombarding him and cutting him off and, like, just going to work. Like, I'm not going to be scared type stuff. Like, I know this is the big guy on the block. This is my first time. I'm a couple years into ESPN. And I'm like, all right, I'm going to make a name for myself on him right now for 2 hours straight. And like during a commercial break, he was like, yeah, you can cut me off, but make sure I get to my point. Like, he didn't care about me dunking on him necessarily. He recognized that sometimes me dunking on him is good for the show. And also, like, if I'm comfortable dunking on him, then I'll be comfortable with him dunking on me. Like, he recognized all that, but he was like, this is a show. And doing it with him gave me a new appreciation, because you remember, I guess, I don't remember what year this was. It's probably 2016 or something like that. And Stephen A has gone through a lot since then, not negatively necessarily, but it's like he's changed somewhat. And he's like more of a American icon, for lack of a better word. Back then, people were hugely critical of him and were like downplaying his ability. They're like, man, he just get on TV and yell. And I had never really given it any thought, but like, I felt I was smarter and I was like, I'll beat him because I'm smarter. But I don't want to say he didn't care about winning, because he obviously cared about winning, but like, he was more concerned with being an entertainer than anything else. And me sitting there, like, he was debating me. Once I started to like play nice and stop trying to be the like rabid little dog who's trying to prove something, and started watching him, the man was making his debates, setting up opportunities for me to come in, directing the show in the camera, all doing all of this without talking. Like, he's looking at the camera and signaling to the control room. He's looking at me and like signaling to me, because you don't want a bunch of dead air, but he understands the use of silence, which is important too, like for dramatic effects. And I'm butting in on his dramatic silences, and he's looking at me like, you messing up the game, young boy.
That's a horrible feeling where Stephen A is sitting right there.
Yeah. And then I started to learn, like, he would give me a look where he was done with what he was saying, but he didn't want to be quiet. He wanted the energy to keep going. And so he'd be talking and looking at me like, come on, like, it's yeah. like, butt in, do your thing. And I was just like, after 2 hours sitting with him, I was like, man, that is a master class. And you don't understand how talented people are until you get up in there and see them work.
Oh, no, no, no. One thing about it is, and you saw this, and you may have even read it this week, Stephen A. wants you to go back and forth with him, right? Like, Stephen A. is not a person that wants you to back down. Don't get it wrong. He does want some deference. Like, he is Stephen A. Smith, right? Like, it's not like when you get on TV with Stephen A., that Stephen A. is like, yo, I'm the king here, and you need to respect it as such. That ain't him. He wants to go on the back and forth. But I've said this for years, and it seems like a more obvious point now, but this is the dead up truth. I get that people who don't do this job don't understand it entirely. Like, it looks like it's very simple to understand in a lot of ways, but they're like elements and components that people don't get. Like, for example, my buddy Stu Gatz works with Dan. When people would first come on and be like, yo, I don't get the Stu Gatz thing, I'm like, I understand, but it's just going to take you a minute. Like, there's a technical element to what Stu Gatz provides that is legitimately brilliant. But if you don't do this, you're not going to be in a position to really like pick up what it is that he's doing in there. With Stephen A. Smith, first of all, Stephen A. Smith is a bright man. Like, I don't say that in a patronizing sort of way. Quietly, he's like one of the more thoughtful people that you have when it comes to giving these answers and talking about stuff. And he's low-key an incredible listener. Like, he's hearing everything you say, and he's rolling with it. And if it's on something that's just not like completely out of wheelhouse, right? He got something for you that he has considered, that he has thought out, that he has stated clearly. You understand every word that he says. He does not stammer. He does not stutter. When it's time to pick it up, he picks it up. When it's time to bring it down, he brings it down. That dude is better at what this thing is that we do than anybody else. And it ain't about whether or not you like it or not.
Yeah. Now, learning that and all the things you said about Stephen A., are true and impressive, and people try to get him for the times when he makes mistakes, but man probably just be doing too much damn TV, and we all gonna make mistakes every now and then. But your point about him being better at this, and your point about people not understanding what's going on, like, I recognize the same thing and Stu guys that you, and like, I don't want to risk overselling how talented some of these people are, but I don't think you can with Stephen A., at least, because the ability to do the things that he's doing. I had this conversation with a lot of people because it took me, I guess, a year or so to realize this, that I wasn't planning on coming to TV. I quit my job at the NBPA and started writing. And then ESPN called me. It was like, you want to write for us? I was like, sure. And then I was asking for too much money. And they was like, well, we don't pay writers like that, so you're going to have to do some TV. And I was like, all right, well, I'll start doing some TV. So I kind of fell into it. And then people at home, like I used to be, you're like, all right, well, the best person wins. The best argument is what you're here for. We ain't here for that. We are here for entertainment. You know what I mean? Like, that's what people tune in for. And understanding that teaching people something is a type of entertainment. Like NPR, they are balling in the podcast game because they be teaching people stuff in an entertaining and interesting way. So like, being bombastic is not the only way to entertain, but that's part of what Stephen A. does. And understanding that you got to turn it down certain times to turn it up. Mm-hmm. You gotta be angry sometimes. You gotta mix it up to keep people going, and understanding the timing of that. And the thing that I have the most trouble with, and you might be able to tell it from the rambling that I just did now, and I do this on Get Up all the time, and I try to kick myself, is like being comfortable with silence. Mm-hmm. Like, I find myself talking fast, find myself trying to fill stuff in, and I find myself trying to outsmart the next guy. Then I have to remind myself that people who are watching this, they've been to work or they haven't. They got kids. They stressing. They want to sit down and they want to be engaged and entertained. Yeah. They do not give a damn if you know the roster's top to bottom. They care if it seems like you mailing it in, or you didn't watch the games, or you don't read about it and you just faking it. But what they really want to do is like either be riveted, laugh, smile, get angry, whatever. Like, it's like watching a movie. Like, people watch scary movies. Those things seem like something that you wouldn't enjoy, but it engages you.
Yeah, and see, the thing about silence is, to help you out with this, just to understand it, the thing is, you got to get to a point where you can use silence as a device. And what I mean by that is, Stephen A. has been doing this so long and has a rep such uh-huh. that when that silence comes before he talks, it builds suspense. Right. If don't nobody know who you are, they like, yo, say something. You know what I'm saying? Right? Like, yeah. like it's not building to anything for those people mm-hmm. if they don't know who you are when you come to right. that silence. But he's reached that point where he knows when to get in there, when right. to get out. Like Ralph Wiley used to say this. I forget who he sent the email to about this after Ralph died. I remember this, where he was explaining to somebody that they were, I think he said Miles Davis. And he was like, I'm Thelonious Monk. And his thing about Thelonious Monk was what makes Monk what he was, and I'm not well-versed in either, just to be clear, but the genius of Monk is what happens between the notes. It's the use of silence, right? Like, that's what that is. Stephen A. is the rare person who uses the silence and uses the space and the noise with the same ability. He's the rare person that can get down with this. But no, me getting in this, because like, look, this come natural to me. This is not something that I've had to do a whole lot. I had to do refining after I got in. But, you know, it's nothing for me to brag about, right? This is a thing. Like with you, you became a good quarterback, but being fast, that was you. Yeah. You was fast where you could move. You know what I'm saying? Dominique got pictures at 6 years old with an 8-pack. But yeah, that just comes for me. I get fortunate in that regard that that just comes for me. But as you get in and do this and you realize like who's good and why they're good, this is simply not a job that everybody can do in spite of the fact that it looks and feels like every, like radio, people realize quick they can't quite do radio. Like drop somebody off and be like, cool, 8 minutes.
Yeah.
Make it happen. You know what you're going to be doing? Oof. Begging people to call. Just want to remind you guys again what the telephone number is.
I remember when you were in Miami, I guess that's when I met you. I came down there and I was doing some show for the Undefeated, and I was just hanging out in the Clevelander studio after Dan's show. I'm writing and you're in there doing the show. And this is after I understand how complicated and how challenging this business is. And then you come in and you do a full radio show by yourself with, I don't remember any callers either way. There might have been some callers, but you do a full radio show by yourself. And Gabe, you can cut this part out if this embarrasses Bomani, but you was playing puzzle games on your iPad the entire show. And I'm standing there like, I would attempt to do something like this to stunt, but you're not even telling people. You out here just how hard, I know how hard it is. And if people think it's not difficult, go ahead and sit yourself in a room and go ahead, like you said, 8 minutes and do engage, turn on your phone and record and try to be entertaining for 8 minutes in a row and not talk to anybody. Just let your thoughts come out for 8 minutes and see how unbearable that's going to be to listen to. And Bomani's doing it while playing puzzle games on his phone the entire time. And I was like, all right, well, some people, like you said, I had an 8-pack when I was 6 years old. And you're right. Yeah, you had this gift.
Spring is the best time to add new challenges to your training. Just in time for summer and warmer days. I've been in the gym a little bit trying to get my fitness in check so I can break these skinny allegations I keep getting. And spring is the best time of the year to take a new look at your fitness routine, dial it up a notch, and continue powering on. Peloton has everything you need to get you where you're going. Whether you prefer to run outdoors, row, or ride at home, or strength train at the gym, Peloton has something for you. Peloton's varying class lengths were designed with your training plan in mind. Personalize your workout. Whether you'd like to add a 10-minute core session at the end of your strength class or take a 60-minute power zone ride to increase your endurance. Peloton classes are designed to help focus on your needs and goals while challenging yourself at every level. Now you can catch up on your favorite NBA games with NBA League Pass while you push yourself to new levels of fitness. Watch your favorite games and win your workouts with NBA League Pass on Peloton and visit onepeloton.com. Peloton All Access membership and NBA League Pass subscription required.
Speaking of 8-pack, I went to the beach this weekend with my family, or last week with my family, and so I'm not much for the social media posting, but my wife's post pictures of us. And so we're driving home and she's like, one of my friends texted me and said, wow, I never seen a dad of three without a dad bod. I count 8 abs. And then I got to hear about this the whole ride home. Like, I didn't tell that girl to look at the picture. I didn't tell her to count my abs. I didn't tell her to comment on my body. What is it? Somehow this is my fault that I'm still sexy? Thank you is what I should be hearing.
You need to check your friends. First of all, I do want to point out that I appreciate Dominique saying about how he thought it was impressive what I did. And then was like, now let's get back to the real dopeness in this conversation. Yeah. These abs.
Yeah. They still hanging in there.
Hey, man,
holding on,
dog. I ain't even mad at you, dog. Like, that's the, you know, now that I'm back on my fitness program, I've been there, you know, for the last, you know, year and change, getting there. I feel like, man, I wasted a lot of time. You know what I'm saying? I couldn't be at no Dominique Fosworth level, but I did. Like, last year was my 40th birthday, and I put a picture up with no shirt on because, you know, I ain't really, you know, doing stuff like that. I was like, yeah, it's kind of working. But you out here making her friends jealous.
Well, I think you decided a while ago. I don't know if you decided consciously or not, but you were like, all right, at least for me, I'll speak for myself. I've like recently, since I've been married, like become a better dresser and like started reading a lot more. I decided when I was 10, I was going to get women by being great at stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be great at football. And that is going to give me the confidence to hit on people. So, like, that wasn't the move. And you may have decided, like, being an intellectual was your move. But once you get a little older, you gotta do a little mix up your game. You got to keep on your toes. You can't be running that same scheme that you ran back in the day. So now you're bringing out the ab scheme. I respect it.
Yeah, now, when I was younger, I didn't know what my game was going to be on it. I was just kind of happened to stumble. But I had quickly done the determination that in 10th grade, I wasn't tall. In 11th grade, I was.
Oh, yeah.
And that made a world of difference. It was immediate. I was the same person that I was at 5'4". It was a whole new ball game once the tall had come around. And I didn't know if that was going to be my thing necessarily. I do remember when I got to college, I tried to tell my brother, I was like, yeah, man, you know, smart dude. That was going to be my thing. He was like, yeah, you might want to attach that to some cool. as a standalone, smart guy isn't really going to do it. Now, it can do it for you first couple semesters in college because people are like, nah, you know, one thing, if there ain't nothing, little boys want to be like the big boys.
Right.
But young adult women, late teen women, you know, they want nothing more than to be grown and, you know, give the air of responsibility. And so having you a smart man, you know, like, I'm tired of being out here messing with them thugs. You know what I'm saying? Like, they want to get them a smart dude. My no game having ass right there just to mess it up.
That's the move for sure. You got to have something to hang your hat on. I guess just for me, I was thinking about how the height changed it and how we're considered the shallow ones. But I think back over my dating history, which was very short. I feel like I only had like two girlfriends before I met my wife, like real girlfriends.
That doesn't mean your dating history was short. That means your girlfriend history was short.
Oh, yeah. I mean, most of the other people didn't go on dates. Those weren't dates. We wasn't going to dinner. That wasn't.
Want to watch a movie?
Exactly. Well, I didn't even have that game. It was pretty straightforward. And I was. Yeah. Come on through after or whatever. But anyway, so I had a thing. You were talking about the guys or women wanted to be with like the smart guy because it's like an air responsibility. Like, the two women that I dated before I married my wife were also lawyers. And then my wife was in law school at the time at a better law school than they went to. And I think I didn't, like, subconsciously maybe, but that was my thing. Like, the beautiful smart girl, oh, you had me. I was through. I couldn't put up no defenses against that. Maybe I wanted to be put on some air of responsibility that was not completely true because... Friday nights, I was not looking for the beautiful, smart one. Looking for beautiful, but smart was not on the docket.
So you like all them damn questions, huh? Like, there's one thing I can tell you. Dating a lawyer is like dating a journalist. Like, why are you always... I thought it was pretty clear what I was talking about. They're not letting anything hang in the air or be ambiguous.
Yeah, the woman I dated in Denver was 28 and I was 22 and she had been practicing a law for a little while. And my little bit of bad game, my little bit of sneakiness, it did not get away. Like, I didn't get away with nothing. She was on top of it. My wife is a lawyer because she went to law school, and she went to law school because she's smart and her older sister went to law school. It wasn't like, so she doesn't like that lawyer stereotype. Like, she's just smart. She taught for a little bit. She didn't know what to do next. Her sister was in law school, and she's like, all right, guess I'll go to law school. So I don't, we don't have the same like a stereotype of a lawyer, but you're right about the other two. It was like, yeah, so many questions.
Yeah. It's just like, yo, it doesn't even, can I finish?
We got the can I finish, that's for sure. Yeah, my wife likes to talk.
Yeah, like just give me, just let me roll, just let me, let's just, can I actually, I thought about your wife this week because it's like coming up on one of the Miss Education Lauryn Hill anniversaries. I tried to joke with Dominique's wife about how that second Lauryn Hill album was whack. All that got me was the middle finger at a wedding. I was just like, oh, okay, this is serious to you.
Lauryn Hill is, well, I mean, just aside from Lauryn Hill, is Lauryn Hill is like the most contemporary stuff that she listens to. Oh yeah, and Beyonce sometimes, but like you would think that you was in your grandmother's house if you listen to the music that's on around here when it's cooking and cleaning time. It's just,
that's a good sign. That's a good sign. That's a good sign. I'm telling you, man, people who listen to old music, man, that is typically a good sign.
I put the AirPods in and listen to something violent instead. something contemporary and violent.
We got to find the old violent stuff for you. You know what I'm saying? Like that's one thing we lose sight of. A lot of that old music is violent. Like somebody put a tweet up the other day. It was like, what's a good song about murder? And I'm like, you need to differentiate between murder and manslaughter, because there's a whole lot of songs about killing people. Whole lot.
Well, Luther don't got none of those. We get a lot of Luther.
Yeah, Luther ain't got no songs about killing people. I ain't really into him as subsequently as a result. Like, I feel like I need a little bit of that tension. I need that. I need to feel like something might happen.
You thinking Marvin Gaye? Like, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah, I guess. Yeah, the tension with him was always like somebody going to die, but the somebody was absolutely going to be him.
We did get some Aaliyah on the drive back from the beach because the music's now out on streaming.
It's back available.
We got a lot of Aaliyah. Then those uncomfortable moments when the random lands on Age Ain't Nothing But a Number, and we look at each other.
Yeah, yeah, gotta stop that. You need to, yeah, like she has no music before One in a Million. Like One in a Million is where this begins, and then we go. And this is, I guess, 20 years since she died, because I remember I was down there in the Bahamas when that happened. And I ain't appreciate the real magnitude of that when it happened. Like I did kind of, because I just wasn't a fan. Like that wasn't my bag. And so she had died. And so, you know, by that point, Kurt Cobain has died. Tupac has died. Biggie has died. I'm used to famous musicians or people in that space that matter to me dying. So it didn't like hit me. Now I'm a grown up and I look back at it and I'm like, damn, man, she was what, 22, 23 years old, like somewhere in there. It's and crazy. The circumstances under which. And then I later found out that I knew somebody who his boyfriend was also on that plane and died. You know, like I did not fully appreciate just how jarring it was for somebody that age and in the position that she had been in to die in that way.
Like you, I wasn't a fan, but I mean, you have eclectic musical taste, which I guess you could explain how that came to be, because I feel like growing up, we grew up around the same time. Like there was no option and sense. And because of it, I've been like indoctrinated to like aggressive hip hop. Like I don't cross over too often. Like there was, I was watching Ted Lasso and they were playing Rolling Stones and my wife was singing along to the Rolling Stones Rainbow. And she was like, yeah, I like this song. And I was like, who that, the Beatles? Like it just wasn't a thing. Like when I grew up, nobody was, you get roasted. And like, I see you commenting on country artists and having a deep knowledge. And I know you were a music critic at one point, but like, it's quite clear that you love this other stuff, which I don't know. How did that come to be?
Couple things, right? So one, I have older parents and much older siblings, right? So my brother is 13 years older than me, right? Two, and this is where the slight age difference between me and you matters in terms of like a discussion like this. So the hip hop that I was really on and really listening to like in the 90s is right before and right after the sampling laws changed.
Okay.
So all the music is built on this previous stuff. And then my brother's doing beats And so, like, I'm with him when he's got the record player out and he's chopping up and coming up with all this, you know, all these things. And I grew up going to school with white people, right? So you then come across, you know, whatever it is that they happen to be listening to. But also, once I decided I was going to be a music critic, I quickly recognized I needed to know more about music. And this is right after Napster came down. And so I started pulling all that stuff down and checking it out. And you realize, like, the music, especially in the 1960s and 1970s, the black music of that time is being influenced by the same music as, for lack of a better term, the white music of that time. So, like, you hearing the commonalities, and it's folks that got it and they can make it happen, you know. And so, like, with the Stones, for example, I could take you through a guided tour of the Stones and you would know what time it was, because it's all dating back to the same stuff that the cats that you like were dating back to, right? And so it went from there, and then I just figured out, okay, I know the kind of stuff that I like, and if you got it, you can go. Now, this country thing is my man Sturgill, and Sturgill's kind of becoming my Bob Marley. People are like, oh, you like reggae? I like Bob Marley a lot, you know? Like, I can't pretend as though I'm a reggae scholar. Okay. I sure can't do it with country, but this dude Sturgill, the baddest man on earth right now.
Yeah, I, like, saw you commenting on that, and I was like, I don't know who Sturgill is. I opened the article that you linked, and I started reading, and I was like, nah, too late for me on Sturgill.
Nah, you know what, though? I could give you a couple tracks, because, like, the point of entry for me on Sturgill is that he did this. I mean, it's a country record, ostensibly, but it's with the Dap Kings. So it's all kind of like, not all, but a lot of that, like, Stax record, horn section type stuff and everything else. And so it's coming on the in between. I realized that Sturgill got me when he put out them bluegrass albums last summer. And I tried that, and I was like, oh, that's just a little bit too far, right?
Okay.
But come around to this summer, and I'm listening to them like, oh, I get what's going on here now. Like, when I was able to bridge into the bluegrass, I was just like, oh, okay, you got me, sir.
I think it's the going to school with white people thing. My high school, my mom wouldn't let us go to our home school, Randallstown. She sent me and my brother to Western Tech, which was like 50-50, black and white. It wasn't like a great school, but it was newer and safer, to be honest. But my middle school, like, I remember the two white dudes, probably like five white girls. There were more Asians in the neighborhood, but not much. It's probably like 20 Asians, but you know how it is. Like, they were immigrants and they had to live where they had to live. In my neighborhood, like, Randallstown, Maryland, is not like impoverished, but it's black. And so, like, growing up with around black people, and during that time in hip hop, everything was so much about being real, you know? Yeah. And so, like, if somebody caught you listening to a rock song, or if you was like, I listened to this rock song, okay, Jodeci, fine, if you got some girls over, but that's it. Don't be out here trying to vibe to New Edition by yourself. Like, this, you better be listening to something that's going to teach you how to sell drugs or kill people. And that's like, so, like, I've broken myself of that some, but not completely, because listening to the Rolling Stones song, and, like, Greenberg sent me a playlist of Beatles songs. And, like, once I could get past whatever mental block, I was like, hey, just jam a little bit.
Yeah, but the other part is a bunch of them cats out there lying. Like, one thing about it, all them cats talking about how it really was. And I've learned this as I gotten older, is how many of these cats is going back talking about how much they love Babyface. You talking about that when he was putting out them simp anthems, like, in real time.
Right.
Like, everybody, man, you listen to that or whatever, please. You could go to the blackest wedding in the world and drop Teen Spirit, and people are going to start throwing chairs around that bad boy. You know why? Because it was one MTV, man. Yeah, like, the thing for, like, people my brother's age and around there, my brother and sister, I suppose, you know, around there, is that, like, that is the dawn of MTV. And so people are sitting around watching that. Like, I remember when I got to college, and me and my boy were talking about this, because I've been kind of cool. Like, if I like this, I like it, it's whatever. Right. But he was talking about the come to Jesus moment he had with his partners when they were sitting around smoking weed, and somebody broke the ice and admitted that they watched the Golden Girls with their moms coming up. Because we all watched the Golden Girls with our moms coming up, because we had no vote on the remote control. And the Golden Girls is, like, great, like, incredibly written and everything else. But no young black dude is feeling like you about to admit that you dare. But as soon as one person breaks the ice and admits it, suddenly it's, picture it, Sicily, 1921. You know what I'm saying? Like, somebody just has to be the person to acknowledge that they are on board with it. And so I've become the person. And I'm going to tell you this. This is funny. I don't think I'm talking out of school on this. I think you'll find it interesting. Very 2021 sort of situation. So I got a DM from a football player that I'd never heard from before. He seemed like a good guy, but I'd never talked to him before. And he was talking about the Sturgill article. And he was like, yo, appreciate it. I know you're a music buff. I'm not the same way, but I had never listened to Sturgill. And so I went and gave it a run. I thought it was interesting. Really dug it. You know, just want to tell you, I appreciate that. Josh McCown.
Oh, yeah.
But stop and think about this for a second. Josh McCown from Jacksonville, Texas, is thanking me for putting him onto the country music. Now, I know that Josh like hooped and all that stuff. Like Josh is, people don't realize Josh crosses the aisle a little better than you might think just on looking at him or whatever, right? But this was just kind of one of those, it's just very interesting to see where the overlaps come, you know, and what it might be. And so if I'm with it, yeah, I'll share it. And then next thing you know, people are like, yo, this ain't so bad, you know?
I'm going to get that Sturgill playlist from you.
I'm going to get you. Plus the other part too, man, at this point, I got too much goddamn money to be out here worried about y'all tripping on what I'm listening to. You know what I'm saying?
That's fair.
Like I get you in here listening to all these new speakers I bought. I bet you love it. Like every now and then, and it sounds bad or whatever, but it's true. Every now and then, somebody got something to say about you. Somebody got this, somebody got that. And you just come back to it and then realize, like, you got to understand, man, I'm a little too paid to be worried about what you think.
Yeah, absolutely. That is absolutely true. I feel that way often, which is why I engage on social media very little. I don't tell them why. I just like, all right, I'm good on this. I just fade into the background. But yeah, McCown's a good dude. I'm not surprised based on what I know about him that he's not up on the Sturgill. But the hip hop music, I remember being a kid and being upset when everyone was like, man, we got to get this music away from these kids because it's ruining them and whatever. And like my parents were engaged, but they were cool parents. So they were like, they were cool on that. They were like, yeah, we don't care. You can listen to the music. Ghetto Boys was my first tape that I ever bought.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's questionable parenting.
Yeah. Well, it worked out. But I do think that it obviously has impacted me. You know, like, I don't want to say fake tough guy, but like this idea of like, I guess masculinity and toxic masculinity is like an American thing, but something about it, what we were growing up on, is different than what my dad was growing up on. Cause like, it was okay to be like a ladies' man and to really be in love and to really take care of your woman. Yeah. Like, that was the thing.
We all know nothing about that.
Yeah. My whole upbringing, all the music I listened to was like,
right. The person you describe is a sucker.
Yes,
like we have identified him as the object of scorn.
I remember like in recent years when like a lot of the rappers started turning to like the popularization of like strip clubs in Atlanta. And a lot of rappers were talking about, yeah, then I'm going to go pick up my girl after she done dancing. I remember like thinking, what? Like, we would roast the dude who would go pick up the stripper after. And I just, like, understanding that I'm so fortunate to have had good parents and my dad, like, setting an example for what it meant to be, like, a good husband and good father and all those things. Because all the other stuff that I was hearing and the stuff, like, we talked about earlier in this thing, like, how I didn't go on dates. Yeah, that's because the music that I was listening to was like, you a sucker if you take somebody on a date. Like you gotta use them and whatever. And like I feel awful about some of those things now, but also I had a great time. And it's just like understanding that all that stuff is blended together. I'm happy with who I became, but that music certainly had an impact on me.
Yeah. And now we are better people. But here's the thing, we got a little mo for the people, man. We got a little mo. We're gonna add a little something on after this. Get ready in 3, 2. All right, man, we got a little bonus material for you guys. I want you to check out the 30 for 30 podcast. It's called The King of Crenshaw. It's a 4-part series on Nipsey Hussle and his influence, not just in music and in Los Angeles, but also in the sports world. And the man behind that podcast is joining us now, dressed nicer than he typically is for Around the Horn, in spite of my attempts to try to get him to look like a grown-up on television. Justin Tinsley is in the house. What's going on?
First of all, I take offense to that. I wear shirts with buttons now. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
I'm just saying, man, I'd be the old dude, man. I'd be having to hit these young cats on Around the Horn being like, yo, man, what y'all out here doing? You know what I'm saying? Clinton Ye's a bad influence on y'all.
Since you brought this up, we can talk about the podcast. Thank you. I did my first episode of Around the Horn. I'm like, wow, I'm on TV. I'm at every bar and every airport in America. Bo called me. He was like, man, what the hell are you wearing? I'm like, what?
But that's my point. Because you're on every TV in every bar in America, I want you to show up in your best way.
And, you know, honestly, I appreciate it. But, yes, thank you. I am wearing a shirt just for you, though.
Dude, I once rolled up on a dude at NABJ and gave him $20 and told him to go get a haircut and get that mohawk off the top of his head. I'm out here to help. You know what I'm saying?
Man, I don't even get me started on Bo NABJ when I was just around him having a drink. I've seen Bo crush spirits in the nicest way possible.
Yeah.
They asked Bo, like, so you got any advice for me? He was like, that's the question. Like, that's the question you have for me? Like, we're right here. We're talking. You can ask me anything in the world, but you asked me for advice.
Well, it's not because they asked me for advice. It's that that's so broad. Of course I have advice, but I can't just, like, usually pull something out of a hat. I don't know you. I don't know what you need. I don't know where you're coming from. You know, that's all I'm saying.
Fill up your tank before you have a long road trip. That's advice.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. I'm not a jukebox. That's all I'm trying to tell them, man. I'm not a jukebox, but King of Crenshaw.
Yes, sir.
First of all, what was it about Nipsey that made you want to do this project?
Honestly, like, we were supposed to work on something, you know, while he was alive. One of my best friends, he grew up in the Crenshaw area, and he's the one that put me on the Nipsey back in like 07 or 08, one of those years. And he hit me up in like 2018. He was like, look, my homegirl works for Atlantic Records, and, you know, they want to try to get Nipsey some coverage from a sports angle because he's a big time NBA fan. And I spoke with her a couple of times, and we formulated an idea because I told her it's stereotypical. It's a famous celebrity and an NBA player taking a picture courtside. But it felt like there was a deeper relationship with Nipsey and guys like Russ and James Harden and, you know, Isaiah Thomas, DeMar DeRozan, and so forth. Like, I wanted to examine, like, what those relationships were really like. And he liked the idea. I don't want to make it sound like we were about to do the interview, like, the next week after that call. But, you know, I still have a notes app in my phone that says Nipsey questions from 2018, but his schedule was crazy that year and it just never worked out. So when he was murdered in 2019, I told myself, like, I really don't want that idea to just stay stuck on the shelf. And one thing led to another. And thankfully, you know, it became a 30 for 30.
Yo, so my thing with Nipsey, I actually met him in 2019 at the All-Star game.
The one in Charlotte.
No, the one in LA. I met him because my man was cool with a dude who worked with Nipsey. And so we watched the game from his box, right? Wow. And so he came in and we talked to him. And it was interesting because up to that point, I had not actually listened to any of his music. I just hadn't gotten around to it. Because the thing with him, the point I'm trying to get to is he is maybe the last hyper-local superstar.
Yeah.
You know, in spite of everybody in these other places, like, eventually caught on, he is LA's dude. Like, that is, like, when you get in and you actually listen to it, if you know a little bit about LA and a little bit about gang culture, like, you realize this is a very LA dude. MC Ren put out an EP in 1993, I think, called Kiss My Black Ass, that you may have never heard a track off of, but it went platinum, because you could go platinum in California. You could go platinum without getting outside of there. And so what it's always interesting to me watching the Nipsey stuff, especially with the LA dudes, because even if we were where we were listening to the music, it means something different to him. Like, I feel like Kendrick Lamar can mean to an LA dude what he means to everybody everywhere.
Yep.
It's not the same with Nipsey. He is South LA in particular, but he is LA's champion.
In music, the word classic gets thrown around a lot. Like, an album will come out and 15 minutes later, people on Twitter saying, oh, this is a classic album. And it's the same way with the word icon. Like, the word icon gets thrown around a lot. But in South Central, South LA, whatever you call it these days, that dude Nipsey Hussle is, you can't tell the history of that area of California without mentioning him now. And if you listen to the podcast, Los Angeles is an essential character. You can't tell Nipsey's story without talking about the story of Los Angeles. So when you talk to DeMar DeRozan, who's featured really heavily in episode 2, which talks about, you know, gang culture in LA, Nipsey is ingrained because they came up around a lot of the same things. They survived a lot of the same things. So when you listen to Nipsey's music, especially if you're from South LA, you hear things like, oh yeah, I experienced that. Oh yeah, I saw that. So when somebody is really speaking your life story in a lot of different ways, the music just hits different. And I like what you said, Bo. Like, he's like the last local superstar. And obviously he became bigger and more prominent in the last year of his life and definitely in depth, but now he's loved in South LA. And you could tell by all the murals down there of him, like, that place will never be the same without him again.
And he put out, so at my age, like, I graduated high school in 1997, for example. You think about the music that was coming out from like 97, really to, I'd say 05 is probably the time we're talking about. It's aspirational music. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like it's hilarious to me when we look back and look at the videos and Cats is out here stunting in expeditions. Because at that time, the people that were making money in rap did not know what all the next level stuff was. So it's like, yo, man, I got an expedition. This was the big deal. And like, you look at the videos, the Cash Money videos, man, baby would never be smirch his butt cheeks with some of those cars that they used to think were fly, you know, but it was aspirational. Yep. Nipsey, to me, after I got into the catalog after he died, that is inspirational music, right? It is not simply about like, this is what I want to be, because there is an element of that, but it is, I'm going to get it. Just you watch.
Yep.
See how we do this. See how we go up. And that's what I found when I was going back and listening to his music. Just to me was just, especially for people in that area that eats its young repeatedly. It mm-hmm. was about a steady grind on how to get this and real true to self in those ways. Like it really wasn't a whole lot of stunting of how much money I got as much as I'm going to get this money and this is why I'm going to get this money. And then we saw, of course, what he then was doing with his money that was, again, hyper-local.
Yeah, he did the thing that, you know, this is spoken about in the podcast as well. And Nipsey's brother, Black Sam, is featured in this prominently as well. And he said that, you know, Nipsey did the thing that a lot of people said they were going to do. I'm going to get money and I'm going to give back to my hood. My guy, Garrett Kennedy, said in there, too, like, there's nothing wrong with getting money and moving away and giving back because a lot of people do it. But you rarely see people get money and then stay in the community and then try to help that community at the same time. Which is why when he was murdered in March of 2019, that community reacted so emotionally because it wasn't just like, oh, this guy, he lives in Calabasas and every now and then he'll come by and pass out turkeys on Thanksgiving. Like, no, on any given day, you could go to the Marathon store and he'd be out there taking pictures. He'd be out there counting inventory. I know a young kid that worked at the Marathon store and every day he would come in, he'd be in the stock room stocking up stuff and Nipsey would just pull him aside. And he was like, yo, man, are you aware how to like invest your money? Do you know what an interest rate is? Do you know what cryptocurrency is? He was like, I never talked to Nipsey about music. And he took a genuine interest in me. And I think a lot of people from that community feel that type of way, which is why that loss is felt so heavily. And it's going to be like a lifetime scar for everybody in that area. But they also cherish him because he cherished that area and he cherished people far beyond what social media sees. When I called this thing the King of Crenshaw, like it wasn't hyperbole. It's an accurate title of who he is and what he represents to that area.
And the music's good. That's a big thing about it. And the music is good in an interesting way to me because he ain't a top five dead or alive MC. I'm not saying that is any sort of insult, but that's not what this is. But the music always feels like something, right? Like it's a very evocative sort of thing that he's got going. Like he ain't about to tongue twist you to death. It ain't about to be about like superior lyricism, but that's not the point, right? Like none of those are me insulting. It's trying to, for those who are not familiar with his music, the music is good because you feel the main character of that music at all times. It is very sincere music. It's very Tupac-like in that way. Like, I feel like in a lot of ways, he's like, what if Tupac has some sense, right? Like, you imagine if Tupac has some sense because you're a little young to understand just how little sense Tupac had. Like, what if Pac had a little bit of sense?
My biggest thing with Tupac was he could have changed the world if he wanted to. But like you said, like, Tupac, you're leaving the Tyson fight, bro. And Nipsey talked about this as well. He was like, Tupac, you're the biggest artist in the world. Why are you jumping a Crip in the MGM lobby, bro? Like, why are you doing that? Suge Knight, you worth $300 million. Why are you doing this? And honestly, the West Coast kind of fell off after that. And, you know, with these new guys coming in probably like a decade later, like Kendrick and Nipsey, they were in desperate need because after Death Row fell off, the only real West Coast artist who made like a national impact, you know, aside from the guys like Dre and Snoop and, you know, Dogg Pound like that was The Game. Other than that, they didn't have anybody. You remember that guy, Gorilla Black?
Yep.
I thought he was a Biggie clone at first, but the guy was from Compton. So they had like shtick acts. So when guys like Nipsey came through, he kind of restored a feeling of yesteryear, but it was also like with a 21st century twist. But yes, like you said, Bo, big fan of his music throughout of his career. But that Victory Lap project is so beautiful, but it's also bittersweet at the same time, too, because it was like, dude, you were getting better as an artist. Yeah. You were getting better at painting pictures. Like you said, he's not going to tongue twist you to death. But if you listen to his music, like, wow, you can check everything he said in his music and it would be authentic, good, bad, and indifferent.
And that was the reason why I heard when he died. I think with Pac, it was like, yeah, I see how that happened. With Nip, it was like, damn, I did not see that coming.
I was just thinking about, like, Bo, I wasn't a big Nip fan prior to his death, but I found out everything he was doing afterwards. And I was wondering, like, the impact going forward. Do you think that this will be pivotal and people picking up his mantle as far as the Marathon initiative is concerned and trying to be more local and trying to reinvest and staying home? Or is that one of one?
Man, that's a good question.
For athletes and musicians and everyone who's touched by him.
the scary thing about his death was that when you think of Tupac, he got killed on the Vegas Strip. When you think of Biggie, he got killed outside the Peterson Automotive Museum. But with Nipsey, it's like he was murdered on the land that he owned. There's a spiritual element there that makes it unique. And I was talking to DeMarcus Cousins for it, and he was like, the thing that scares him the most is like the thing that Nipsey loved the most, which was his neighborhood, which was his community. It kind of took him away at the same time, too. Obviously, the community didn't do it. It was one person, but I do hope that moving forward that people understand the ethos of what he was trying to do, like invest in your community, put money into your community, because that's the only way this dollar is going to circulate, because we understand like the economic and systemic disparities that go into these communities. And the only way to uplift these communities is to be an active participant in uplifting them. So, you know, I hope guys around the NBA and just people in general understand the value of community investment. It sounds great talking about it on social media, but like what the application is going to be, I hope if people, you know, love Nipsey and respect him the way that they say they do, apply some of those principles that he operated with into your own community. And that's the way to keep your own personal marathon continuing. It's not about trying to mimic everything that Nipsey did to a T, because it's like a fingerprint. It should be different for everybody and it should look different for everybody else.
All right. That is Justin Tinsley. Check out the King of Crenshaw 30 for 30 podcast, wherever you get your podcast. Oh, and this dude writing a book with Dwayne Wade. I feel like I should just throw that in there right fast. Tinsley, we all going to be working for Tinsley very, very soon. My man, I greatly appreciate it.
Yeah, appreciate y'all having me on. Thank you, fellas.
No problem, man. And ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing 3 times a week. Gabe Bassan and Dave Presley handling everything behind the scenes. thank you, gentlemen. Remember, follow The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. We'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or follow on the ESPN app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.